From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Russian army tipping the balance in eastern Ukraine. Death toll in the Gaza conflict now more than 700. Poland fined for hosting CIA black sites. Plus what it's like to live with HIV in Cambodia. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine's national security spokesman said Thursday Russian forces are conducting a multifaceted campaign from their own side of the border against Ukrainian troops. The allegation came a week after the downing of the Malaysian airliner in the rebel-held part of eastern Ukraine. As more of the bodies were flown to the Netherlands, and international observers made their first visit to what they say is a major impact site. VOA's Al Pessin reporting from Kiev.
Colonel Andriy Lysenko says the Russian troops across the border are using a variety of weapons to attack Ukrainian units that are fighting Russian-backed separatists.
Були здійснені обстріли з установок ГРАД з території Російської Федерації блокпостів в районі.
Lysenko said in the last 24 hours, Russian forces have fired GRAD missiles at six Ukrainian checkpoints, including one at the Luhansk airport. He says they also fired artillery shells, grenades, and small arms at various locations along the border. At Kyiv's International Institute for Policy Studies, Yaroslav Kovalchuk says the direct action by the Russian army significantly changes the military balance in the region.
There are Russian troops that try to provoke a Ukraine army, that try to destabilize the whole border, but Ukrainian troops cannot answer anything because it will be considered as a military response. So the situation is very tricky, and the direct involvement of Russia really aggravates the whole status quo in the east.
The Russian military involvement appears to indicate that President Vladimir Putin is not willing to allow the separatists to lose in eastern Ukraine, but Kovalchuk says Mr. Putin's calculation may change in the coming months in the wake of the Malaysia Airlines disaster and as international sanctions begin to bite. Meanwhile, Ukraine's prime minister submitted his resignation, paving the way for parliamentary elections in October. Arseniy Yatsenyuk said defections from his coalition and parliament's failure to enact his reform program caused the move. The parliament was left over from before the ouster of the pro-Russian president in February. In eastern Ukraine, rebels have allowed only a limited number of foreigners to have access to the crash sites. Most of them are observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, along with a handful of international experts who've managed to reach the area. In a cell phone call, OSCE spokesman Michael Butsurkiv told reporters that a week after the incident, members of his team finally got to one of the major crash sites on Thursday.
Just now we visited impact sites, which, again, we hadn't visited before, but it had by far, I think, the most pieces of large kind of intact debris. In a wooded area, for example, we saw a piece with the window still intact, and it was very, very large.
But Surkiv said he saw no local experts working in the area on Thursday. The head of Ukraine's Emergency Services Agency says there's no plan for locally based workers to resume the search until experts in the Netherlands determine how many bodies have already been recovered. Initial reports said all 298 bodies were aboard rail cars sent out of the rebel zone this week, but officials say that may not be true. The emergency chief said the last of the bodies received from the train should be transported to Amsterdam by Friday. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kyiv.
United States is accusing Russia of firing on Ukrainian military positions in troubled eastern Ukraine from inside Russia, and Washington contends Moscow intends to supply pro-Russian rebels with bigger and more powerful weaponry to fight Kyiv's forces. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf.
We have new evidence that the Russians intend to deliver heavier and more powerful multiple rocket launchers to the separatist forces in Ukraine, and have evidence that Russia is firing artillery from within Russia to attack Ukrainian military positions.
Spokesperson for the U.S. Defense Department said Russian forces fired artillery shots into Ukraine on Thursday. He described the Russian assault as a clear escalation of weeks-long fighting in eastern Ukraine between separatist rebels and the Ukrainian military attempting to retake control of the rebel-held cities. A freelance journalist working for CNN has been abducted in eastern Ukraine, the latest in a string of attacks on media workers in recent weeks. The U.S. network made Anton Skiba's kidnapping public on Thursday, 2 days after armed separatists allegedly took him from a hotel in the troubled-held city, the rebel-held city, that is, of Donetsk. Skiba, who last week had worked for the BBC covering the deadly Malaysia Airlines crash, said in a brief phone call with CNN on Wednesday that he was being questioned at the headquarters of the Donetsk Security Services. The network had not immediately publicized Skiba's abduction, as efforts were made since Tuesday to obtain his release. The Committee to Protect Journalists called for Skiba to be freed, as well as a British freelancer, Graham Phillips, who worked for Russian state-owned channel RT. An unidentified cameraman was with him when the pair disappeared Tuesday near the Donetsk airport. You can stay on top of what's happening in Ukraine at our website, voanews.com. And still ahead on International Edition, we'll go to Cairo, where a correspondent updates us on U.S. Secretary of State Kerry's efforts to get a Gaza ceasefire.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook, VOA Asia.
Israeli strikes continued in Gaza on Thursday, and rockets fired by Hamas-led fighters in the enclave landed in Israel as both sides maintain their conditions for a ceasefire. VOA Scott Bob reporting now from Jerusalem. The number of Palestinians killed in the conflict has surpassed 700, while the death toll in Israel rose to 35.
Israeli forces bombarded targets in the Gaza Strip, and Hamas-led fighters in Gaza launched rockets and mortar shells on Israel, despite efforts by international mediators to negotiate a ceasefire. Gaza health officials say an Israeli shell slammed into a UN-run school in the northern Gaza Strip, killing at least 15 people and injuring dozens more. The UN has confirmed the school at Beit Hanun was hit, but could not confirm the number of casualties. The school served as a shelter for hundreds of Palestinians. After meeting with British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Hamas militants are using Palestinian civilians as human shields and complained Israel is being criticized for defending itself.
This use of human shields is extraordinarily cynical. It's grotesque. It's inhuman. But what is equally grotesque is that Israel was condemned in the Human Rights Council.
Hamas leader Khaled Mashal denied the charge of human shields. During a news conference in Qatar, he said Hamas would accept a temporary humanitarian truce to allow aid to reach civilians in Gaza. But he said it would not accept any agreement that did not end the suffering of Gaza residents. He says everyone wants us to accept a ceasefire quickly, but then what? They say we then should negotiate our demands. We reject this idea. We rejected it on the first day, he said, and we will reject it in the future. Hamas says Israel must lift its blockade of Gaza and cease all aggression as part of any ceasefire. Israel says it wants Gaza to be demilitarized. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
UN Secretary General said he was appalled by the carnage at that UN school in northern Gaza Strip, where explosions killed and injured many women and children, as we just heard in Scott's report. VOA's Margaret Bashir, though, has more now from the United Nations in New York.
Ban Ki-moon was in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil Thursday, part of his shuttle diplomacy efforts in the region to reach a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas militants, when he spoke of the attack. Mr. Bond strongly condemned the shelling, which also killed UN staff members. He said circumstances of the attack were still unclear. In New York, the Secretary General's deputy spokesman, Farhan Haq, said all the facts were not available in the immediate aftermath of the attack.
At this stage, we do not know, and I cannot verify who attacked the compound.
The UN chief has called repeatedly on both sides to avoid attacking UN premises. More than 110,000 Palestinians have sought shelter in UN schools and other facilities since the fighting began. Israel accuses Hamas militants of deliberately positioning their rocket launchers in Gaza's densely populated residential areas, raising the risk of civilian casualties when Israel fires back. In the last few days, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has found two separate weapons caches in facilities that it operates, one in a vacant school and the other in a school where the rockets subsequently disappeared before the authorities could seize them. The UN condemned the incidents, saying they are unacceptable and that those responsible are turning the schools into potential military targets and endangering the lives of innocent persons seeking shelter there. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry remains in the Middle East trying to come up with a ceasefire plan for Gaza. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns is traveling with Mr. Kerry, that is, who is in Cairo. Scott brings us up to date on Secretary Kerry's busy day on Thursday.
Secretary Kerry had another busy day here in Cairo, speaking with regional foreign ministers about preparations, what it's going to take, really, to get back to the 2012 ceasefire between Israel and Hamas over Gaza. He came back here to Cairo after a full day in Israel yesterday and has spent the day trying to follow up on some of those meetings. He spoke with EU High Representative Cathy Ashton, with the French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, and the UK Foreign Secretary, as well as the Jordanian Foreign Minister. Now, some of those conversations have a number of issues, but again, the focus has really been to try to get back to a cessation of hostilities in Gaza. The Norwegian Foreign Minister, which may seem the outlier on that list, Norway, as you know, has played a role in the past in the Middle East peace process and would likely be part of the negotiating set. Were the sides to get to a ceasefire, part of that would be, it's my understanding that this would be a temporary ceasefire, not necessarily a withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, that would then lead to some more formal talks between the sides about some of the underlying issues in Gaza, which for Hamas is chiefly the Israeli and Egyptian blockade. That's a little bit harder this time because Hamas believes that some of the things that it was promised in the 2012 ceasefire were never delivered on. So the incentive this time would be the participation of more of the international community at the table, the a suggestion that by having other players there, that what would be agreed to in the talks after this ceasefire to deal with some of these issues would be more likely to be delivered.
That is VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reporting from Cairo. U.S. airlines are resuming flights in and out of Israel's Ben-Gurion International Airport after 2 days of cancellations brought on by the conflict in Israel and Gaza. Delta, United, and U.S. Airways all announced the decision to carry out scheduled flights on Thursday. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration removed restrictions into Israel late Wednesday, and the European Aviation Safety Agency lifted its restrictions into Israel on Thursday. However, some European airlines, including Lufthansa and Swissair, are suspending flights into Israel for another 24 hours. The bans went into effect Tuesday after rocket fire from Gaza hit near the airport just outside of Tel Aviv. Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, says searchers have spotted the wreckage of an Air Algeria plane that went missing Thursday on a flight from Burkina Faso to Algiers. There was no immediate word on possible survivors. Authorities said 116 people were on board that flight. We get more now from Jennifer Lazuda.
Burkina Faso's Ministry of Transportation says that there were 110 passengers and 6 crew members on board, including 50 French citizens and 24 Burkinabe. They said most of the passengers were in transit to destinations in Europe. Security officials in Mali told VOA that the plane was last seen on radar over northern Mali, between Gao and Tisali, near the border with Burkina Faso. Officials said the plane requested to change routes about an hour into the flight because of stormy weather. It is not yet known if weather played a role in the plane's disappearance. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
In a landmark ruling, Europe's top human rights court has found Poland violated the rights of 2 terrorism suspects by allowing the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to secretly imprison them in the country more than a decade ago. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris on that ruling.
The European Court of Human Rights says Poland violated the European Convention on Human Rights by allowing terrorism suspects Abdelrahim al-Nashiri and Abu Zubaydah to be secretly imprisoned on its territory between 2002 and 2003. The two are now inmates at the Guantanamo Bay, Cuba detention camp operated by the U.S. military. They claim they were captured and then flown to a secret jail run by the Central Intelligence Agency in a Polish forest where they were tortured and mistreated. The court, which is based in Strasbourg, France, blames Poland for facilitating the process. It ordered Warsaw to pay fines to the two men. The ruling is the first time a court has acknowledged suspects were held and tortured at so-called CIA black sites under a program launched by Washington following the September 2011 terrorist attacks. The United States has acknowledged the program existed, but has not named the countries that cooperated with it. Lawyers for the two suspects and rights groups hailed the ruling. Amnesty International's terrorism and human rights expert, Julia Hall.
For years and years and years, we've sought accountability for these practices in the USA. There's been virtually no accountability there. So to have a European government and, in fact, an EU member state found responsible is quite a significant step forward.
Poland's foreign ministry said its legal experts need to fully examine the ruling before commenting, but President Bronislaw Komorowski called it embarrassing. The court also said Poland's own investigation into the allegations is ineffective. Rights experts like Hall say the ruling may also have implications for Guantanamo Bay trials against terrorism suspects like al-Nashiri. He's accused of orchestrating an attack on a U.S. warship in 2000 that killed 17 American sailors.
The fact that the European court has ruled that he was disappeared, he was tortured and otherwise ill-treated, all of that information will be very relevant to the proceedings at Guantanamo Bay in terms of mitigating the death penalty, which is really the ultimate human rights violation as far as Amnesty International is concerned.
The ruling may also have implications for other European countries suspected of participating in CIA secret detentions. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In conjunction with the International AIDS Conference underway this week in Melbourne, Australia, VOA is presenting a special series of reports that take a global yet personal look at AIDS. Although HIV/AIDS is now a treatable condition, a positive diagnosis is still a life-altering experience. In today's report, we travel to Cambodia, where people living with HIV are often disowned by friends, family, and the community.
Each morning as Uk Navi stands in front of the mirror, she glances at photos of her late husband and remembers the good times they shared. He committed suicide after learning he was HIV positive. After her husband's death, Uk Navi continued to live in her home near the Thai border.
Shortly after I held the funeral for my husband, I was looked down on and treated differently by the villagers. Children in the village started making fun of my son, saying your father had AIDS. He might have infected the whole village.
When villagers set her house on fire, Uknavi returned home to live with her sister near Phnom Penh. She was sick often, and a test revealed her worst fear. She was HIV positive.
My only sister and cousin showed disgusting behavior toward me before we ate together. But after I was known as HIV positive, they would not eat with me. Even when my child was playing around, they called him AIDS child.
Cambodia offers free medication for the country's 70,000 people living with HIV. But many must move from the countryside to cities for treatment. Those with little means live in squalor. Feeling desperate and alone, Uknavi contemplated following her husband and committing suicide.
I felt so sick and skinny, and I no longer wanted to live. Then I thought of my son and took pity on him. So I strived to survive. Just for him.
Uknavi is now feeling better, both mentally and physically. She receives housing, food, and medicine from Place of Rescue, a Canadian organization that supports people living with HIV. It is her son who brings her life purpose. But her thoughts often wander to her late husband.
I feel anger and regret every day. If only he was still alive, he would have received medicine and felt healthy like others with the disease. He shouldn't have been so short-sighted and decided to kill himself.
Check out our full series of reports on AIDS and that AIDS conference in Melbourne, Australia at our website, voanews.com.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
U.S. State Department says a computer glitch will delay passports and visas being issued from its embassies around the world. Officials here in Washington say the glitch discovered potentially could leave millions of people waiting for U.S. travel documents. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf said the problem is worldwide and not specific to any country, documents, or visa category. She says it will stall the issuance of U.S. passports, visas, and reports of Americans born abroad. The State Department working to correct that problem, but has given no time frame for when it will be fixed in place. International Monetary Fund has trimmed its global economic growth projection for 2014, projecting a slower advance in the United States. The IMF report says domestic demand will ease in China and economic activity in Russia will be decelerating because of tensions over Ukraine. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, if you find yourself on Twitter, you can check us out there. I'm at VOA Norman, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news. It's coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On July 25th, 1898, during the Spanish-American War, U.S. forces invaded Puerto Rico, one of Spain's colonies in the Caribbean. U.S. forces secured the island by mid-August. The Treaty of Paris in December, ending the conflict, officially awarded Puerto Rico to the United States. Today, Puerto Rico is a self-governing U.S. Commonwealth whose people are U.S. citizens. On this day in 1917, during World War I, a French court found Dutch exotic dancer Margaretha Zella guilty of being a German spy. She was executed 3 months later. A courtesan who was linked to various powerful men across Europe, Zella was better known by her stage name, Mata Hari, a name that became synonymous with the archetype of the femme fatale. On this day in 2000, an Air France Concorde jet crashed upon takeoff in Paris, killing all 109 on board and four on the ground. An investigation showed the plane struck a piece of metal on the runway, shredding a tire that was thrown into one of the engines and fuel tanks, igniting a fire. The crash, the first by a Concorde, came just 3 years before the aircraft ended commercial service. On this day in 1969, U.S. Senator Edward Kennedy pleaded guilty to leaving the scene of an automobile accident that had resulted in the death of a young female passenger. A week earlier, 28-year-old Mary Jo Kopechne died when the car Kennedy was driving went off a wooden bridge on Massachusetts' Chappaquiddick Island. As the two were leaving a party, Kennedy received a 2-month suspended sentence in the incident. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Biodiversity is the degree of variation of life on Earth, and it is essential to life as we know it. Efforts to conserve biodiversity and ensure its sustainable use help to maintain the natural processes that create the ecosystem services that enable development: food, fiber, fodder, pollination, clean water, productive soils, and wood. Biodiversity conservation has other benefits, too, and can lead to additional positive outcomes such as building empowered local communities, diversifying livelihoods, promoting gender equality, increasing government transparency and accountability, and contributing to peace and security. Today, some 1.6 billion people depend on forests for some part of their livelihood, while another 2.6 billion people in developing countries depend on fish for protein and income. One of every three bites of food we eat is the result of the work of pollinators, and the total economic value of insect pollination worldwide is estimated at about $210 billion, representing 9.5% of world agricultural output in 2005. Unsustainable development is a major source of pressure on biodiversity, and poor management of forests and fisheries and unbridled exploitation of natural resources, including animals, are destroying entire ecosystems, decimating local communities, and causing unprecedented rates of extinction of plant and animal species. Nature is being degraded, and the world's poorest people, as well as those living in forests rich in biodiversity, are impacted most keenly. Given this connection between poverty and the loss of biodiversity, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently developed its first ever formal biodiversity policy, which builds upon its 3 decades of work in this area. As a result, USAID will focus investment in specific crucial geographic areas, while continuing to use the best science available and to work with partners to address threats to nature such as wildlife trafficking and illegal logging. It will use approaches to conservation that have worked well in the past, such as close collaboration with local communities, ensuring that local knowledge is respected and applied to development challenges and management of natural resources. USAID will also seek to make use of the latest science and technology and deploy the best new tools and methods to solve the biggest conservation challenges. USAID will do so in partnership with the private sector, non-governmental organizations, research institutions, and other government agencies. We consider the stewardship of nature critical and effective strategy for ending extreme poverty and fostering resilient societies, said USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah. With this policy, USAID is well positioned to chart a development path that nourishes rather than depletes natural capital.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.